Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. In Chicago, nearly 90 million Americans are under heat alerts, with record-breaking temperatures bearing down on the West and Southwest. Scott Johnson is with the Salvation Army in Phoenix, Arizona.
Extreme heat is Arizona's natural disaster. So for the Salvation Army, this is a disaster response. Today, we are tying a record 18 straight days of 110 degrees or more.
CBS's Jonathan Vigliotti on other parts of the country.
The heat dome now stretching from the desert southwest all the way to South Florida. Miami-Dade County with its first ever excessive heat warning. In Salt Lake City, the asphalt buckled. And in Connecticut, country music star Jason Aldean was overcome by heat during a concert.
It was a combination of dehydration and just heat exhaustion.
Thousands of acres across California are freshly charred due to wildfires. A sudden thunderstorm on Saturday night sparked flash flooding in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. A family's car was swept away, killing Katie Seeley from South Carolina. Her 9-month-old son and 2-year-old daughter are still missing. There's more rain in the forecast. CBS's Lana Zack on the surge.
It's hot here. All of that makes these search efforts all the more difficult, but at least that break in rain has allowed search and rescue efforts to continue.
The toddler's father, grandmother, and a brother survived. The presidential campaign of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has drawn criticism from some Republicans over what some saw as the GOP candidate's struggles to rise in the polls after early enthusiasm over his candidacy. CBS's Robert Costa says DeSantis has just implemented a campaign staff shakeup.
Hello, South Carolina!
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis hit the trail amid a campaign shakeup, laying off about 10 staff members as he struggles to gain traction in the crowded GOP field. DeSantis made the moves after burning through cash faster than most of his opponents in the second quarter, spending about 40% of what he's raised.
I think we've got a lot of work to do over these next 18 months.
CBS's Matt Piper has the latest on the strikes by Hollywood actors and writers who failed to reach a deal with major studios.
From coast to coast,
writers on strike.
There are now even more Hollywood workers on the picket lines, with SAG-AFTRA union members joining WGA union strikers. From actors like Kevin Bacon in New York City.
I just have to, you know, hope that we're going to get a fair deal and that they'll come back to the table.
To writers like Jeff Astroff in Los Angeles.
We're waiting for the studios to come back. If the studios want to end this tomorrow, they can.
They're asking for streaming residuals and protections around the use of AI. Matt Piper, CBS News, New York.
Veteran police official Edward Caban becomes the first Latino to head the NYPD. This is CBS News.
Need to hire quality candidates fast? You need Indeed, the end-to-end hiring solution. Attract, interview, and hire candidates all in one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
For WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles, and here's what you need to know. The current air quality in Waukesha, Milwaukee, and the surrounding region is good. The forecast indicates that the air quality will remain unchanged tomorrow. Following the victim's death, charges against a 64-year-old Brookfield man have been upgraded in relation to an alleged assault outside of a Heartland bar last month. The new charge against 64-year-old Kevin Schemer is second-degree reckless homicide. The victim's family attended the court hearing and advocated for a $1 million cash bail, also suggesting that the incident should be treated as a hate crime. Two people were taken to the hospital after a crash involving a Milwaukee County bus this morning. A car collided with the bus near 35th Street and North Avenue at around 6:15, with North Avenue temporarily closed. I'm Stuart J. Waddles, and this is WAUK News.
Hey, this is Matt from Design Garden. Remember when the internet was new? Back then, you had to leave your house to start a business. Companies used to pay programmers bags of cash to get online. Now, small businesses can get online with a Facebook business page, or Squarespace, or Google My Business, or WordPress. But which tools should you use? Can you afford to go down the wrong path? Design Garden uses modern tools to build your website the right way. Find us online at design.garden. Again, That's design.garden.
This summer, 540 AM WAUK has a new lineup.
Yes, that's awesome.
Starting at 6 AM, Up North News, 8 to 10, The Earl Ingram Show. Mondays, 8 to 9, Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. 10 to 12, As Goes Wisconsin. At noon, Civic Media Network News. At 12:15, Town Call. 1 to 3, The Todd Alba Show. 3 to 4, Matt Flynn Direct. 4 to 6, The Devil's Advocates with Dom and Crute. And 6 to 7, The Maggie Dawn Show on 540 AM WAUK.
It's so hot. Wait. Now it's going to rain? It is summer in Wisconsin.
As much as we love it, we love to hate it too. Find a forecast you can count on along with the in-depth details you need, only from the Civic Media Weather Team.
These extended conditions have led us into a flash drought. Sitting in these above average temperatures with minimal rain has swiftly altered the local climate.
Your weather and more for your part of Wisconsin.
On your local Civic Media radio station and streaming on the Civic Media app.
The Civic Media app.
Join us daily at therickssmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, welcome back to Netroots Nation here in Chicago. As you know, we've been talking about over the last couple of days, this idea of everyone here, they've got their idea, they've got their issue, they're networking, they're coming together, figuring out, you know, a bunch of fire-breathing do-gooders looking to change the world. But, you know, here's the thing. All of this coming together, all of these conversations, all of these planneries, all this stuff, not going to really matter if you don't get people out to the ballot box, people who are going to vote. And we talk about this all the time. Take these issues, get them into the ballot box, get elected officials who are going to take that and march us forward. And for me, that's what this all comes down to, active and engaged voters. And here to share some thoughts on how we get people to vote easier and maybe vote from home like we did during the pandemic, I've asked Barbara Smith Warner to come talk with us. She's the executive director of the Vote at Home Institute, voteathome.org, their website. Barbara, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, my pleasure.
So what is the Vote at Home Institute? What do you guys do?
Sure. So our mission is to make voting at home, to increase voters' access to, use of, and security in voting at home. I'm from Oregon, where we started voting at home back in 2000. So we're coming up on 24 years.
So you've been doing this a while. Home.
You know it.
So all the dead people are voting in Oregon, though.
They've all been taken out. There's a lot of security in a vote at home system. It's a very structured system where ballots go out automatic. In a full vote at home system, ballots are automatically sent to every active registered voter for every election. They get sent out about 2 to 3 weeks before the election, depending on every state's regulations. And you have 2 to 3 weeks in your home to research all the races, to find out all you want, and then you can return it in any number of ways. You can mail it, sure, the same way it came to you, but in Oregon in particular, more and more people return it in person. They might put it in a ballot box, they might take it to their county clerk's office, they might take it to a regional election center. There are still folks who like that election day balloting feeling, and they can take it to an election center and either turn it in that day, or if they want or need to, if they need assistance with that ballot, they can bring it in. There's machines there on which they can vote. It's really kind of a full spectrum. And if you think about how we do more and more of our lives now, of having things come to us.
Yeah, right? We'd never have to leave the house.
Exactly. You get your food delivered, you get your DoorDashes, your groceries. And we really believe that we need to center the voter in voting. If you think about most of the problems we have with voting, the long lines, right, the disenfranchisement, that is all taken away.
Yeah.
Voting at home is just, it's foundational small-D democracy.
No, I see it. You know, I've always liked the ritual of going to the polls.
Yep.
Now, here's the thing. I've always lived in a neighborhood that's been well-resourced. And this has been this has been my privilege, I guess, as a voter.
Yes.
I've always lived in an area where there have been plenty of machines. The longest I've ever waited to vote is like 35 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I grew up in a place where I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. And I now look at what, you know, what I, if I were still in that community, hours long, you know, 10 hours long, which is insane.
Right.
And I know they do that on purpose to keep certain groups from voting. And there's, sure, there's a structural part to that.
Yep.
So this would alleviate some of that.
Yep.
But what do you say to the person, Barbara, who goes, yeah, we're going to send out all these ballots, but a lot of people move around. And those ballots, they're going to get into the hands of the nefarious crowd who's going to, they're going to undermine the whole system and destroy it for everyone.
Right. Well, the biggest piece of security, I would say, that is part of all of the vote at home systems now, there's 8 states and the District of Columbia that are all fully vote at home. This is something I didn't realize until I started doing this work. As an Oregonian, I just thought, oh yeah, this is what we do. But 8 states and DC are fully vote at home. And one of the key elements is signature verification. So if you get my ballot and try to send it in, you have to sign that ballot.
Oh, I'm screwed.
And, right?
Because I can never sign my name twice the same way ever.
Well, here's the deal. In most, in I believe all of the vote at home states, but most of them, there's a couple things. First of all, the good systems are ones where they compare your signature to a whole range of signatures. The one maybe when you registered to vote when you were 18, one from the last time you got your driver's license, the DMV, they keep a variety, and even like your prior signatures. So good systems keep a whole bunch of your signatures and can check on that.
Yeah, we do that in Pennsylvania. When I go and I sign the book, yep, you know, they do have my original signature.
Exactly.
There.
Yep.
And she looks at me and she goes, yeah, close enough.
Right.
I
right.
know you. You've been here long enough.
Exactly.
Close enough, but maybe penmanship wasn't your thing.
Amen. Well, and you know, and I've got 2 kids who cannot read cursive and they can barely write it. So that's going to be another longer term issue, I would say, for the society as a whole. But the other thing that we have in voting at home is also pretty key. It's called curing, which is a word that took a long
See,
time
now I was
for me
ask
to wrap
you about
my head
this.
Around it.
Yeah.
So, and you, I don't know why, if this is why, but the idea is if there's something wrong with your ballot, you can cure it. You can fix it. So your ballot comes in, and I'll give Pennsylvania for an example. Pennsylvania has what we think is not ideal, but the folks who do vote at home in Pennsylvania, you have to sign and date your ballot.
Right.
If it's not dated, they're supposed to contact you and allow you to cure it. But in fully voted home system, it is run like clockwork. It's a combination of, first of all, they all have ballot tracking systems, which is another big part of security, right? So you order something online, you get a notification that your order was received, when it's in transit, blah, blah, blah. Same idea with your ballot.
Yep.
In Oregon, for example, and in most of the vote at home states, you get a notification, hey, ballots have been mailed out, keep an eye out for it. Then you get it. Then when you return it, you get a, hey, your ballot's been gotten in the mail or received from the Dropbox.
Yep.
Yep. Your ballot has been entered into the system to be counted. It's fantastic. So first of all, if you don't get that, you can know that. And if your ballot comes in and it needs to be cured, you are contacted. And you have, ideally, in what we consider a best practice, is to have a week after Election Day for you to be able to find out that something's wrong with your ballot and cure it. In some states, they have text to cure, where Colorado was a leader on this, where if your ballot comes in and there's something wrong, they'll contact you and they will text you if you provide them with your number, and you can text back a copy of your driver's license, you know, any like the secured items,
sure,
that they need to confirm that that was your ballot. So there's so many safeguards,
okay,
and side rails around
it. That was a huge question, because I know I have a friend in California who says, you know, a lot of ballots are thrown out and never counted because of these security, we'll call them security protocols.
Yeah.
Your signature, a box wasn't checked.
Right.
You know, something wasn't sealed. You know, there's a bunch of things,
yes,
that, and a lot of votes that most people don't even know about, you know, get thrown,
right,
out. So
right,
there, this has been thought out, and you have a process,
correct,
to ensure that every vote is counted.
Yes, that percentage is actually shockingly low. I think if it happens to you once, you're probably very well aware of it. But yes, there are systems that are set up that we've learned over time. California is kind of infamous in that they do not give a lot of time for what's called pre-processing, which is getting those ballots in and getting them organized, getting the outside envelope, confirming who it is, having the security envelope, all that stuff. But there is, yes, California, that is one of the things they are working on improving, is their pre-processing and also their curing process.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Barbara Smith Warner. She's the executive director of Vote at Home Institute. VoteAtHome.org is the website if you want to take a look at that. What do you say to the person who goes, you know what, I'm a traditionalist, and I am. I want to cast my ballot. Instead of going through all of these extraneous, opportunities of, sending out ballots and doing all this stuff, why don't we just make voting a national holiday? We resource the places much better so that we celebrate the act of going and voting.
Yeah.
And we celebrate the idea that we're engaging in democracy. What do you make of that argument?
I mean, I think it's got a lot of validity. And if, the truth is, though, even if you make it that, it is, you're still shoving it all into one day. And if you think about ballots where more and more things are, whether it's a ballot measure or, they're trying to reorganize the whole way. Every year in Ohio, they change their minds about how you can or cannot do ballot measures. So they're having another special election about it. The idea of really centering the voter, and you don't center the voter necessarily. Would I love it if Election Day was a holiday? That would be fantastic. And it's still going to be a Tuesday. There's still going to be people who don't get that day off. Those are going to be the people for whom, voting is probably both most important and least accessible. And to me, the key that the importance is centering the voter, is getting it to the voter, is giving the voter that time to do the research, find it out. In Oregon, we have, and it's slowly rolling out to other states, we have something called the voter pamphlet that comes a week before the ballot's due, where every candidate who's on the ballot gets a half page to put their picture, their name, educational background, occupational background, and then 325 words to say whatever they want. And so you get this in the mail. For the candidates, it's very cheap, but you get this in the mail that has every race that you're going to be voting on, these people in their own words, every ballot measure that's on, and we are legally required to have a plain language explanation. I'm a former legislator, and I was on the committees to try to write plain language versions of ballot measures in the past. Let me tell you, it's quite challenging.
Yeah.
But this is, again, this is another element of how do we make this really voting is the baseline of our democracy, our small d democracy, it's about the voter. What can we do to make it easier for the voter and to yet empower them even more? Give them as much information as they need. Give them the time to do it. Give them the multiplicity of ways to return it. That's great that you are used to, that it is important to you to vote in person, and you still can through this. But what about my kids, who in Oregon are automatically registered to vote because they both have driver's licenses, and now they're like, they just get it, and they're like, oh yeah, they fill it out and whatever, and it's done. It's the idea of voting at home is the one thing that can encompass all of that. It can encompass everybody, the people who want to go in person, the people who want, they don't want to think about it, they the people who want to take a lot of time, and everything in between.
No, it sounds like a great idea. Folks, take a look at the website, voteathome.org. If you want more information on the Vote at Home Institute. Yeah.
And in particular, can I tell you, there's a scorecard that we have on that website, and it says how vote at home friendly is your state. You can click on your state and you can find out, because there's a whole range of things we can do. There are states where you still need a legally specified excuse to even get.
That's how Pennsylvania was.
Yeah. Yes, and now Pennsylvania has moved to no excuse required. And then there are states like Illinois, where we are now, where not only do you not need an excuse, you can sign up. You can do what we call a single sign-up. You get your ballot every time automatically. So that moves you closer and closer to that full vote at home. So take a look at your state. See if they have online voter registration. See if they have a curing process, if they pre-process those ballots. A lot of good information, and reach out to us if you're interested in making a change in your state.
There you go, voteathome.org. Barbara Smith Warner, appreciate the time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Want to hear your thoughts. Are you in favor of voting at home, the mail-in ballots? I know my conservative friends are going to be losing their mind, but interestingly enough, a lot of Republicans coming around, because understand their base, a little bit older, a little bit less mobile, ready to stay at home. I think we're going to see it. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to Netroots Nation. If you missed any portion of our program, make sure you grab the podcast. And, you know, all of the interviews, all of the folks we've talked to here at the Big Powwow will be available on our podcast site. So make sure you check those out. Really important stuff. Also want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Climate being a big part of this conference. In fact, a lot of the young people that we've had conversations with, climate is the issue for them. Because, hey, they might want to have, if they're going to inherit the planet, it might, I don't know, they might want it to be worth something. Anyway, here to help us figure out how we do save the planet and how we do it in a way that isn't destructive to the working class, I've asked Ben Beachy to come talk with us. Ben is Vice President for Industrial Policy at the Blue-Green Alliance. Ben, thanks for taking time for us.
Happy to be here.
So, you know, you're in this room and you've got all these folks. Climate seems to be front and foremost. What are you hearing?
Well, yeah, it goes back to actually why the organization I work for was created. I work for the Blue-Green Alliance. And it's a coalition of unions and environmental organizations. And our purpose is to unite unions and environmental groups to fight for win-win policies that can support a livable climate and good union jobs and a fairer economy all at the same time.
Give me an example of that win-win scenario you're talking about.
Well, we fought for years, and then about 1 year ago, we got the Inflation Reduction Act, the largest climate investment in history, over the finish line and passed into law. There are more than 100 programs in it. It's about a $400 billion investment into a new economy. And basically, you know, the challenge of climate change, addressing climate change, requires us to build a clean economy. And that creates a real opportunity, if we get the details right, to create good union jobs and invest in hard-hit communities that have not seen investment in decades, right? And so I can speak to some of the particulars in the bill, but just to say that there's a lot of potential for that trifecta of climate and jobs and justice embedded in this law.
No, and that's important because, you know, every transition, you know, be it, you know, the Industrial Revolution or every technology change or any of that, the working class and the poor are always the ones who take it on the chin. And the folks at the top never seem to lose out. So to have this kind of, the word that I keep hearing is a just transition, seems kind of important, especially the folks in this arena.
Yeah. Let me give a couple particulars that matter for good jobs. You know, for too long, there's been a disparity in job quality between clean energy jobs and traditional energy jobs, right? You know, I'm from West Virginia, from center West Virginia, coal mining country. And what we try to do in this law is start to close that gap by boosting the job quality of wind and solar and other clean energy jobs. I can name two examples. One is for construction jobs and one is for manufacturing the components that go into our wind and solar. For construction jobs, we got into the law, basically you get a wind and solar developers get a bonus tax credit, a much, much bigger tax credit, five times as big, in fact, if they meet prevailing wage and apprenticeship requirements. So that is, if they pay workers fair wages and provide like stable career pathways, they get a much bigger bonus. We actually just asked we commissioned a study from some researchers at Princeton and Dartmouth to figure out how big of a deal this is. Basically, solar developers and onshore wind developers cut their costs by 60% if they choose to pay their workers well, right? So it now pays to pay workers well in clean energy.
A matter of policy. This isn't just benevolent employers.
Right.
This is a policy choice.
Absolutely. That has always been the right thing to do. It is now the most economical thing to do.
Yeah, but anyway, at the end of this, you know, you go, it shouldn't have to be this way. I mean, we shouldn't have to be forcing people to do the right thing all the time, should we?
We shouldn't. Trusting in everyone's goodwill has not been a solution to date. And so, you know, the theory of change here is that you invest in the sectors of the economy that are strategic for creating good jobs, for tackling climate crisis, for redressing historical injustices. And you do that by tying a lot of strings to the money, right? You have you basically say you will be able to cut your costs by 60% if you pay your workers well. And again, like, you know, that is basically aligning the business case for good jobs with the moral case for good jobs for the first time.
Now, I look at this, and again, as I've talked over the years about the need for government procurement and the need for policy to encourage the things that we want and need and to ensure that those come with the kind of strings that you're talking about for better wages, hours, conditions, and all that stuff for workers. It's great to finally see it happening. But the argument I get from my right-wing friends is, well, it's going to inflate the cost. We could do so much more of your hippie, liberal, Green New Deal kind of stuff if you just did away with those things.
It's absolutely not going to inflate the cost. It actually brings the cost down considerably.
But for the taxpayers, you said it's a $400 billion bill, and the $400 billion, we could do more, they say.
Well, you have to look at the other side of the ledger, right, which is like how much this is going to contribute to good, high-paying jobs and economic growth and redevelopment in hard-hit communities. So on the I just named what it does for construction.
Right.
Let me name for manufacturing. You know, for too long, we have been tying our climate goals to overseas supply chains that are marred by labor abuses, higher levels of pollution, shipping bottlenecks. And instead, for the first time with many of the investments in this law, we have the opportunity to build our clean energy future on a foundation of good manufacturing jobs, cleaner manufacturing, a reliable industrial base, greater equity. And just to cite one stat from that same study I just named, these researchers found that thanks to one of the tax credits in this law, it becomes cheaper for the first time in U.S. history to manufacture wind and solar components in the United States than to import them, right? So we have the opportunity now to build the cleaner, fairer, stronger supply chains for clean energy that we need. And
give us the opportunity to be a global leader where we should have done, I don't know, 40 years ago when Reagan tore the solar panels off the White House.
Yeah, maybe instead of subscribing to neoliberalism and basically pinning all of our societal goals on the whims of individual corporations, we should have had a strategic plan and, I don't know, industrial policy to reorient our economy to the goals of climate, jobs, and justice. And that is what we're trying to do now. Let me just name that, like, the job's not done yet, right?
Right.
I mean, like...
No, we got a long path. But this legislation was a huge win to move us in that direction.
That's correct. And we still have work to do to make sure that all the money in this law translates into real on-the-ground benefits for working people, for families and communities. As an example of that, a lot of the work since the law passed about a year ago has been to shape the rules that are going to guide the money going out the door. And there's been a fair amount of success in getting some rules that are pro-worker, pro-equity in there. As one example, some of the grants and loan programs that are going to be going out the door, where the money's going to be going out the door in the next year, have rules that basically say, we're going to prioritize funding for corporations, for businesses that work well with unions, that employ union labor. Well, that's negotiating leverage, right? For unions to basically say to local businesses, hey, you want to talk? Like, if you want to position yourself for accessing these federal funds, you would do well to talk with us as the union and negotiate a collective bargaining agreement,
right.
Negotiate a neutrality agreement, et cetera. Similarly for community groups on the ground, like there's rules that suggest that the businesses that will be prioritized for funding are those that actually sign legally binding community benefits agreements with workers and with community members near these facilities to basically put into a legally binding contract tangible on the ground health, economic, and environmental benefits for the workers inside the facilities and the communities on the outside. Again, that's negotiating leverage for unions and community groups to say to local businesses, if you want to get this cash, we should talk. We should make sure that we enshrine in a legally binding contract real benefits for the rest of us.
No, I mean, you lay this out, and there's an exciting future here, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. I mean, I you know, we have, again, our work cut out for us. It really, like, the passage of the bill was really only halftime in this fight. The second half is implementation. But there are organizing hooks embedded in this law that provided an opportunity not just to change the way we power our economy, but to change the distribution of power among our communities.
Ben Beachy, Vice President for Industrial Policy at the Blue Green Alliance. BlueGreenAlliance.org is the website if you want to take a look at the work that they do. Appreciate you taking time for us.
Thanks for having us on.
I look forward to talking to you again real soon. Want to hear your thoughts. Are we doing enough? Is this going to be what helps, I don't know, my kids have something worthy of inheriting? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1917. That was the day 50,000 lumber workers across the Pacific Northwest participated in an industry-wide strike called by the Industrial Workers of the World. The IWW had been organizing loggers for years around wages, hours, working conditions, and camp sanitation. The IWW began building for the strike in the aftermath of the Everett Massacre the previous fall. Elizabeth Gurley Flynn started touring camps in Idaho. By March, the Wobblies established Local 500 of the Lumber Workers Industrial Union in Spokane to organize across the region. In his book, Emperor of Timber, historian Eric Loomis details the chronology of events that led to the momentous walkout. In Idaho, loggers began walking off the job in April when demands for improved bunkhouses and food, higher wages, and the eight-hour day were refused. The strike spread to Washington State, the rest of Idaho, and into Montana and Oregon. Loomis notes that by August, they made employers feel their wrath. The strike cut production by over 80% and threatened war material. Infuriated timber bosses demanded federal troops be sent in to crush the strike and IWW leaders be prosecuted for treason and sabotage. Raids and arrests were orchestrated throughout the Pacific Northwest, and the strike began to stall. After 10 weeks, the IWW called off the strike, but instructed workers to quit work after 8 hours. They continued to lead sanitation-related job actions that would substantially change conditions for the better.
50,000 lumberjacks, 50,000 packs, 50,000 dirty rolls of blankets on their backs, 50,000 minds made up to strike and strike like men.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
The political extremists demanding that government control every woman's personal reproductive decisions claim that they are pro-life, but that's a rhetorical fraud. Look at their overall policy agenda, and you'll see that they are merely pro-birth. After that, adios, baby, good luck. They consistently join Republican lawmakers to kill public programs that deliver essential real-life needs to babies after they're born. Consider child care, a fundamental need in any society, yet the leaders of our rich, sophisticated nation that supposedly treasures family, work, and children have created a Mengi system that literally is a crying shame, revealing that our society deliberately does not care for children. Here's reality for you. 98% of American workers are better paid than those we entrust to care for our children. Working at a nail salon, loading boxes at an Amazon warehouse, flipping burgers at McDonald's are jobs given more pay and respect than most child care jobs. This is not just a poor people's problem. For the lack of child care availability, affordability, and quality is a looming crisis for a majority of American families. Nonetheless, Republicans, enabled by corporate Democrat Joe Manchin, recently killed funding for a program to both raise worker pay and lower the prices families are charged. Such care is too expensive, squawk the same lawmakers who routinely dole out billions in welfare to corporate profiteers. But wait, the GOP has come up with a genius, low-cost solution. Relax safety and educational requirements for child care centers, as Iowa and Montana have already done, allowing 16-year-olds to provide care for up to 15 children each. This is Jim Hightower saying, to support life, not just birth, join up with the First 5 Years Fund, FFYF.org.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So one of the things we've been talking about here at Netroots Nation, had Randy Weingarten, president of the AFT, on the program the other day. Education front and center, you know, the attack on education, a lot of big money, a lot of billionaire money going into attacking public education, coming up with silver bullet solutions. And I got to tell you, one of the things that I found most interesting in my conversation with Randy was, you know, the fact that, look, our kids are a little bit behind. And there's got to be a plan to move forward. Don't destroy public education. How about use the infrastructure to move us in a better direction? And that's why I've asked our good friend Jeff Bryan to come talk with us. Jeff is a chief correspondent over at Our Schools. Their website, edpolitics.org. He's done a couple of panels, done some facilitating. He is the go-to guy. At least he's, for me, he's the go-to guy. Jeff, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on the show, Rick. Always a pleasure.
It seems like the only time we get together is here, and why is that?
Busy people, and also the progressive agenda is packed, right?
Yeah.
Netroots Nation is a perfect example of how packed the agenda is. This is my 14th Netroots Nation. I've done an education panel 7 or 8 times. So I come here just to make sure that education is present. And it's because, quite frankly, you know, okay, Randy was here the other evening. She's great. But people other than the teachers' unions need to be talking about this, because it's an existential the attacks on school are an existential threat to our democracy.
Yep. I agree.
Yeah. Public schools are foundational to democracy. Once you privatize it, you take the democratic control and governance out of it, and whenever that happens, the kids who are the most marginalized, the most vulnerable, they get screwed.
No, and that's the sad reality. With Education Incorporated, it's all about the money.
Yes.
If you don't have the money to be able to send your kids to whatever school is available, then they're out of luck.
Yeah.
And my fear becomes, you know, this idea, because like in our state, they're trying to do opportunity scholarships or some kind of voucherizing. Yes. or whatever it is. And it's never the entire cost. It's, you know, here's $5,000 to send your kid to a $50,000 private school. Most working people are never going to be able to afford that, but it is a nice little windfall for the rich people who send their kids off to these things.
Well, let's talk about vouchers. Here are the facts. Here's a fact about vouchers that everybody needs to know. They're often sold as like a ticket out of a failed school for a struggling family. The reality is, in most of these states where voucher programs have been rolling out or are currently rolling out that have a universal eligibility, in other words, nearly all or all families can take advantage of the voucher. What we're seeing is that 3/4 of the people who are using these vouchers never had their children enrolled in public schools to begin with.
Right.
They had their kids in private schools. They were homeschooling their kids. So instead of a ticket or to an opportunity, it's a coupon for whiter, wealthier families to take advantage of the public tax dollars that are available from these irresponsible programs.
But what do you say to the person who goes, well, you know, we're in a school district where the local public school is failing. This is a lifeline, because I get this all the time. This has been the sale to inner cities. This has been the sale to poverty-ridden rural areas, that while the public school is just failing and it's at the bottom, we need competition, Jeff. We need to make the public school better by adding competition. What's the argument there?
That's an illusion. The reality is, and there's data to back this up, in programs such as Arizona and Indiana that have had these vouchers now for quite some time, what often happens is that, okay, maybe it's a school district that might be defined as struggling based on their test scores. But what we're seeing is that kids that take advantage of these vouchers, they do worse when they travel over to the private system. They don't get better results if there's any kind of assessment done at all. Sometimes there's no assessment. You can't tell.
How do they do worse?
If there's an assessment involved, their test scores go down, particularly in reading and math.
Now, why don't we hear that? I mean, because, you know, I know why, I think, but I want to hear you say it. You know, why don't we hear that being published? Why isn't that being put out by our media structure? Why is that not out there?
Because you've got a right-wing machine, a propaganda machine with dozens of think tanks across the country with big billionaires backing it up, like Betsy DeVos, that put out this message about, well, kids need an opportunity to leave the failing system. Unfortunately, we've also got some people on our side, they call, you know, they're Democrats, sometimes they even call themselves progressives, who've bought into that. They believe it too, and they use the same language. But if you follow researchers like Joshua Cowan, for instance, he has looked at the data and found out that a school voucher program has a worse impact on student performance based on testing than what happened during the pandemic.
Wow. And then from what I'm hearing, the pandemic was really bad.
Yeah. But if you look at the data on the impact of school vouchers, vouchers are worse.
So now we're adding the pandemic and vouchers, because it seems like everybody's on the voucher bandwagon now. Iowa, a huge voucher program.
Right.
Things going to get that much worse?
Yes. I think an important point to look at is who is resisting vouchers right now. There is a bipartisan opposition. You didn't see it in Iowa, but you definitely see it in Texas. And so who are the Republicans that are fighting vouchers? Well, in states like Texas and Alabama and Oklahoma, it is Republicans who live in rural communities. They're fighting vouchers because they realize there are no private schools where they live, right?
Right.
Or they might have to, you know, they might have to...
There could be some popping up.
Yeah, well, you know, what would be the quality of those schools? Okay, right. They're teaching kids in the basement of a Baptist church. Also, they realize that taking the money away from their local schools will kill their community. The local school oftentimes is the number one employer in the community. It is the center of rural culture. Friday Night Lights, we've all heard of that. Yeah. What happens when the schools lose their resources and can't have the band anymore at high school halftime shows?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, I keep saying that, you know, this is, you know, you're splitting the pie, you're creating two competing systems, and you're not increasing the amount of money going into it, so somebody's got to suffer. And I would love to believe that we can have these competing systems, but you can't. I think we should be spending all of our money on one good system, and we I don't think we're spending enough money right now, but this just seems wrong-headed.
Yes, it also creates a fracture in the community. When people realize that they can't get together in an institution like a public school, they start going their separate ways, and the ability of a community to rise up and oppose other things, like, let's say, a new highway expansion, or Walmart coming in and opening up schools and bankrupting the mom and pop grocery stores, they can't fight that either.
Right.
Because they used to have a school as a rallying point, and now they don't even have that. It's just every person, every family for itself.
Yeah.
And that's,
no, no, that's
what
a hyper individualism.
Yeah, absolutely. Hyper individual. That's what the right wing is counting
yeah.
on. They know that will undermine our power as citizens.
Listen to the Rick Smith Show with Jeff Bryant, Jeff's chief correspondent at Our Schools. You can check out their website at politics.org. We'll get links out on social media. Now, I'm sure you saw the Moms from Misery or Maniacs from Misery conference in Philadelphia,
right.
and it's all about, you know, we've got to protect the children. You know, we got to. It's all about hyper centered on protecting the children, and pushing this frame that, you know, teachers are groomers and all this stuff.
Right.
It's really meant to destroy your local schools, and surprisingly, in my conversation with Randy Weingarten, she's like, look, you know, the reality is they're the loud, most vocal, but the majority of parents want their kids to go to a good, well-funded, well-resourced public school with a qualified teacher at the front of it. How come that doesn't get the kind of media attention? I get why the song and dance people over on the other side, who are the loud minority, they get so much attention. Why aren't the rest of us, you know, more vocal and more angry in this moment?
You're going to you're talking about a fundamental flaw of the progressive movement, and a blind spot that progressive donors have. we sort of expect the New York Times and the Washington Post to highlight what's going on in schools in an authentic way. When a survey after survey comes out from organizations like Pew that show that the massive majority of parents like their local schools, even during the pandemic, people, when they were asked, is your local school and your school teachers, are they doing enough? They said yes.
No, look, I love my kids' teachers. And here's the difference, I think, in a lot of the Maniacs for Misery crowd. I actually know my kids' teachers.
Right.
You know, I know what they're learning.
You know he's not a Marxist. Right?
Yes, I don't believe they're indoctrinating. I believe they're educating, and I believe they're guiding a path along with me as a parent. And I fear that too many people have bought into that frame of, you know, they're indoctrinating our kids, and, you know, it's all communist Marxist ideology, without actually knowing any of their teachers. Or the other one, and this is my favorite, well, my kids' teachers are okay, it's all those other ones.
Right. You know, you talk about indoctrination. The really ironic thing is, okay, Moms for Liberty accuses public schools of indoctrinating. Let's have vouchers instead. The vast majority of private schools that are taking in voucher money across the country are religious schools.
Yeah.
Right? They won't.
The greatest indoctrination center,
right,
ever.
I mean, there's one that I know of in North Carolina that the teachers have to be they have to show their religiosity by being able to speak in tongues, in order.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
And where do you go to school to learn that?
Yeah. Well, your evangelical church. There are private schools that get voucher money, and they explicitly say on their website, if you don't have a traditional gender relationship in your household, either your parents or you don't identify in the traditional gender, you're not accepted here. We don't welcome you. There are private schools that get public voucher money that say if your kid has a certain kind of disability, you're not a good fit for our campus.
Yeah, no, and that's really
like,
what
it is. So who's indoctrinated?
Yeah, this is what it's about, isn't it? It's about rolling back all of, you know, the 20th century of progress for minorities and for disabled folks and for all of the quote-unquote others, isn't it?
You know, and Moms for Liberty and these other groups say, you know, we want choice. But choice for who?
Yeah.
Yeah, they want the choice to go to an indoctrination, a true indoctrination camp, and have the public pay for it. Now, the people who are left with, they want real choice, which is a school that's open to all children, right? That's where you have real choice. They're being told, no, you have to pay for our indoctrination camps. You have to pay for our choice. We used to pay for it ourselves, but we're tired of doing that.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those weird moments, because my kids, I want them to be good citizens. I want them to be able to operate in society. And I think public school is a way to help move in that direction so that they understand there are differences. They don't have to lead the lives of their friends, but they have to understand that we're all part of a community and there are going to be differences, and that's okay.
Yeah.
That's actually a good thing. I fear that we have this mentality that, you know, blinders on, you know, only my way or the highway kind of thinking, which, I don't know, is antithetical to the American experience.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people here are talking quite honestly about the moment we're in right now.
Yeah.
Somebody on a keynote yesterday called it a clapback moment where okay, you know, we've had some progress on civil rights and respect for different differences. And now the right wing is pushing back against that. It's happened before.
Sure.
And they always go back to Brown versus Board, the
right
decision that opened the schools to all children, and also IDEA legislation that opened schools to all ability levels. That's where we're getting that clapback that they're talking about.
Yeah, there's always going to be a blowback.
There's always going to be a blowback.
Yeah. So as the old white guy here, because you and I are the old white guys.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, look, this is the we're the minority in this environment.
Yes, we are.
you know, what do you think of where we're heading and you know, what's going to come out of this? Because ultimately, this is great. People are coming together. They're sharing ideas. They've got their issues. But ultimately, if you don't go back and do some persuasion and convince others that this is a direction that it's okay to be okay, yeah. It's okay to be decent to others, and we turn these into electoral victories, it's not going to matter much.
Well, you bring up, you know, the age thing. Obviously, this is not my first NetRoots Nation.
We've gone to the first ones.
Yeah, we went to the first ones. I can say with authority that we talk about education different now than when we used to. When I first started going to NetRoots Nation, Michelle Rhee was a hero. When we talked about education...
Tell us who Michelle Rhee is.
Okay, she was a former district leader of the Washington, D.C. schools. She was famous for being on Time Magazine, on the cover of Time Magazine, for showing up in a schoolroom with a broom. She was calling teachers, basically... dirt that needs to be swept out of the classroom. Some people thought of her as being heroic for that. She was calling for school vouchers and charter schools. At the same time, she was being paid to run a school district that was in sore need of more resources and supports. So she went on to become famous, and some people thought that that was heroic. Well, now people, when they talk about vouchers and charter schools here at NetRoots Nation, it's taken a long time, but they know it's not right. They know that privatization is bad for public schools.
Privatization is bad.
Yeah.
That's the answer, and not just for public schools, for public utilities, for public right. roads, for parking. You know, you go down the list, prisons, you know, our electoral system, you know, our judicial system, all bad.
Yeah, and we're here in Chicago. You know, the saga of the parking meters,
sure.
right?
Well, I'm suffering under it because my hotel, the valet, doesn't know how to drive a stick shift.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, they wouldn't take the car. So I got to find street parking or lot parking. Or,
yeah. Cause, well, it's all owned by a corporation yeah. now. Yeah. So, you know, I have to say that, you know, a role is for older people. People in a community like this is not to necessarily come in and feel that you got to educate everybody because you don't know the expertise in every community
right.
and you have to listen and learn. And I like to think over the years that I've been doing that, but it is important to speak about a historic context.
Yeah. And I have institutional knowledge.
Yeah. And I think young people now, they are quick to get things that, frankly, our generation is completely lost to.
So there's a lot of stuff here that you go, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm with you. You know, go do your thing. Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. There's just some things you go, I don't know.
Yeah.
Not for me.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that young people, they might not know all the nuances about what's wrong with what's happening to schools right now, but they get it. Yeah. Because they've been raised in it,
yeah.
right? They experienced these schools that are having their resources taken away, that they're restricting their learning to just what's going to be on the test, that have a school-to-prison pipeline situation. They have more cops than they have counselors. Okay, they've lived through that. They don't need to be told from older people, well, you know, here's what's going on in schools. They know the immediacy of schools better than we do. So that's where I see the opportunity in meetings like this is not only to present, you know, my historical perspective, but also certainly to learn from them, their firsthand experience.
No, that's why these things are always – I always come away with something positive,
yeah.
always.
Yeah,
always. But, Jeff, as always, I appreciate you taking time for us. I'm going to say what I said again last year. Don't stay away so long.
Okay. I'll try not to, Rick. Thanks again.
Good stuff, Jeff Bryant. He's chief correspondent at Our Schools. Make sure you check out the website, edpolitics.org. We'll get links out on social media. I can take a look at that. Quick break. Right back here from NetRoots Nation.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1944. a crew of mostly black soldiers were loading munitions onto ships at the Port Chicago Naval Magazine in California, northeast of Oakland. 320 soldiers were killed by a munitions explosion that wounded another 390 people. Troops were segregated. Black enlisted men were often given the worst and most dangerous non-combat jobs. All of the munition loaders at Port Chicago were African American. Every officer was white. The sailors were not given proper training in the loading of ammunition. The idea of loading munitions scared the soldiers. The officers lied and said the job was safe and that the weapons could not explode. They were wrong. The explosion caused a giant fireball that killed everyone on the ship and on the pier. The explosion could be heard 200 miles away. Of the 320 people killed, 202 were black. Only 51 bodies could be identified. Ordinarily, soldiers traumatized by the death of fellow soldiers were given 30 days leave. None of the black soldiers, not even those who were hospitalized, got leave. All of the white officers did. Surviving soldiers refused to load munitions. For that, they were arrested. 40 were charged with mutiny. The rest of the soldiers were also punished. They were sent to the Pacific Theater, forced to do menial duty. Many received bad conduct discharges at the end of the war, making them ineligible for military benefits. Those charged with mutiny were sentenced to 15 years of hard labor. When World War II ended, the imprisoned soldiers' sentences were reduced to 2 years. And in 1999, President Bill Clinton pardoned one of the survivors, 79-year-old Freddie Meeks.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something in your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Hope you enjoyed our time here in Chicago. Looking forward to the trip home. We've just the crew has had such a good time here. Got to see a Cubs game, went to Buddy Guy's legendary blues club, spent a little time there listening to some incredible music. I love Chicago. It's one of my favorite places. You know, growing up in Cleveland as a kid, it reminds me an awful lot of Cleveland and just a bigger version of it. But we just had an incredible time of, you know, taking public transit and having to find parking. Funny story that I'm going to leave Chicago with that have never had happen to me. I have, and I guess this is, again, old white guy curmudgeon-y stuff, but I've never owned a car that doesn't have a stick shift. Every car I've owned throughout my whole life has been a stick. It's been a manual. We went to the hotel in downtown Chicago, and, you know, we pulled up and there's nowhere to park, so you have to valet. And the valet comes out and he goes, okay, here's your ticket. He gets in the car and he spends like 5 minutes, you know, adjusting the seat, adjusting the mirror, you know, making the steering wheel just right. And then you watched him and he's looking around and he has no idea what that thing it was so funny. He had no idea what that thing was. So then he comes back and he goes, you know, hey, we can't take the car. There's no one here to be able to park it. And I'm going, seriously, you work as a valet and don't know how to drive a stick? And the answer was no. In fact, none of the people do. And I didn't think it was that rare yet, but evidently, you know, I guess I am the outcast in Chicago, because while we were there, I had three people come up to us and take pictures of the wheel cover, because I've got a Jeep Wrangler. It's got the wheel on the back, and my wife bought me a wheel cover that has the stick shift pattern on it with the words, you know, my anti-theft device. And it was a joke. I didn't know that it was real. It's one of those things where I'm going, that's a funny joke. That's, you know, but look, everybody knows how to drive a stick. You know, how can you not? I stand corrected. And for the folks there in Chicago, I did offer. Now, here's the thing. There's the difference between me and most people. I would mock, and I did. But I also offered to say, hey, you know, I can teach you. If you're willing to learn, I can learn you. I can help you figure this out. It's not hard. Any idiot can do it. This one does. But that was turned down roundly by management.
And I ended up having to find parking all on my lonesome. But that was my funny favorite Chicago story. Again, I hope you've enjoyed the time here. I hope you've enjoyed what we've talked about. I really want to know what you think. If there's something that makes you go, I'm uncomfortable, I don't agree, that's the space I want to be in. Because I think we have to have some real conversations around just people having the right to exist and understanding each other. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where coming away from this, that's where my mind's at in this moment. But we're back in the studio tomorrow, back live and in person, so looking forward to that. Appreciate you tuning in. Don't miss out on the podcast if you miss any portion of the program. Wherever you get your podcast, you'll find ours. Thanks for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.